This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
Minding Creative Minds is a comprehensive well-being and support program available 24/7. Specifically designed for the Irish creative sector, including professionals in the film and TV industry. Experience peace of mind knowing that a skilled team of trained counsellors and psychotherapists are at your disposal. They provide medium-term intervention and expert guidance on managing day-to-day challenges that often lead to anxiety and stress. Discover the valuable assistance Minding Creative Minds offers by visiting mindingcreativeminds.ie today. Take the first step towards enhanced well-being in your creative journey in confidence.
Hello there, and welcome to this latest episode of our industry film and TV podcast, Film Network Ireland Rap Chat. I'm your host, Remy Michelle Clark. As always, we are excited to bring you exclusive interviews with some of Ireland's top filmmakers, actors, and industry insiders for a varied and exciting look behind the scenes of what it's actually like to work in the film and TV industry across all departments on the island of Ireland. Rap Chat is available on Headstuff Plus, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you find your audio content relating to film and TV. Today, we welcome the wonderful writer, voiceover artist, actor, and Corkman, Gavin O'Connor, to our show. Why not consider becoming a supporter of Film Network Ireland on buymeacoffee.com/FNI and sign up to become a member so you can benefit from all sorts of little extra perks like tickets for screenings, tickets to our meetups, discounts, and so much more. You can find out more about us on social media on Facebook and Instagram on @FilmNetworkIreland and on the Twitter machine @FNI_film. So sit back, relax, grab a cuppa, and let's get the camera rolling. This is the FNI Rap Chat podcast, and we're here to celebrate Irish film and the people who make it possible.
How are you doing?
Thanks, Remy. Thanks for having me. I'm good. I'm enjoying the weather.
Good. Yeah, I see you're wearing shorts today.
Yes, obviously you're going to comment on my legs being so white they nearly blinded people on the way in. But
I did. I had my sunglasses on, so I was actually okay.
Well, because at least I factor 50 on.
Well then, you're fine.
We don't all have sallow skin like you, Remy.
Well, that's true. But Gavin, you and your lovely pasty legs, can you tell me what is your origin story? And to kind of be clear about what I mean here, if you could think of yourself as a Marvel character for a second, just imagine Gavin as Marvel character. What were the reasons and, you know, the series of events that led up to you choosing to become an actor?
Actually, very clear. I was in UCC doing a degree in English and psychology, and I was very, very young. I went to college at 16, so I was graduating at 19, and all my contemporaries, all my friends, had a very, very clear idea of the paths that they wanted to take. And a friend of mine, Deirdre McCarthy, who's now the head of current affairs at RT, at the end of my degree said, you really need to pursue acting. This is what you were born to do. And I wasn't sure. And I was kind of, she said, look, there's a drama degree in Trinity and you should really go and audition for the pure acting course. So she helped me with two audition pieces. One was Marullus from Julius Caesar and the other one was Billy Lyre. Would you believe? Janie, how can I remember that? But I went up and auditioned thinking there wasn't a hope in hell that I was going to get in here, because you had people from all over the country coming who were far more down the line than I was, and they were coming from the student drama festivals and they'd won gold medals, and I was quite daunted by the prospect actually, but I don't know why, but they picked me and I got in, and maybe they saw a rawness, maybe that I wasn't as polished as some of the others. So then I went to Trinity and I studied drama in Trinity, which was a culture shock, as you can imagine. I actually texted Lenny Abramson during Normal People and I said, you've literally captured some of my life here with Connell going to Trinity. That's what I was.
Totally fish out of water.
I was a fish out of water. I was the centre forward from Cork coming up and everybody was talking about philosophy and Nietzsche and going to the Philosoph and all these things. You know, I'd had the college experience, but if I hadn't had that and come straight from school, I think I would have been absolutely dwarfed by the experience. But Lenny then said, yeah, he said, you went in as Connell, but you came out as Marianne, which was a great line from Lenny, to be fair to him.
Yeah.
So I found my feet eventually and I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I loved it. I just loved acting. I just felt like I kind of came alive when I did it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked really, really hard in Trinity, like way more than UCC. UCC, I was too young. I was just enjoying the experience more than the academic side of it. Mm-hmm. But then once I got to Trinity, I just went, right, this is what I want to do. And I focused. And then I nearly got into trouble. I nearly got kicked out of Trinity because I secretly auditioned for a Disney film before my graduation. And word got back. And they said that if you go for the Disney audition, that you may not be able to graduate. And I said, well, surely that's the whole point of the course, right? You know, this is what we're aiming at. This is the ambition. But I did it. I didn't get it. But it was a director called Brian DeSalvo, actually. He was doing The Crucible with us, and I was playing Danforth in The Crucible. And from that then, my origin story was my first audition out of drama school was for a local County Lonesome by Pat McCabe,
mm-hmm.
For the lead role. And myself and Flora Montgomery played lovers in it. And it was set in Monaghan. So I was this tearaway who'd just come out of prison. And Pat McGrath was in it. You know, lovely Pat, lovely mm-hmm. actor. And it was directed by Joe O'Byrne. So Joe actually gave me my first break. So my first walk onto a stage in Dublin professionally was in the Olympia Theatre on opening night of Dublin Film or Dublin Theatre Festival. And you know, obviously, Taoiseach, President, everybody there.
Wow.
The flat went back. There was a guy from Cornwall called Simon who used to pull back the flat, and I used to walk on like a bloody cowboy. And then he goes, all right, my little free code, Wanda, go for it, which apparently was the line they used to say to the Rolling Stones. So I jumped on the stage and sat and jumped onto a bench in an abattoir and sang Folsom County Blues by Johnny Cash in my first ever scene in professional acting life on the stage.
What an opening.
Nearly shit myself, but anyway, you know, it's but, sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, please. Go ahead.
No, but I mean, I remember standing there looking at this wall of people, you know, as a very, very young actor and going like gulped. I actually physically gulped and went, am I ready for this? And I just went, okay, fuck it, let's go for it. Let's just go for it. Can we curse?
I don't know, but yeah.
Feck it. let's go for it. So I just went for it and I just tore into it. And theatre then was a passion for a number of years. And I was very lucky. I got to play The Gate. I got to do Borsal Boy with the wonderful and much missed and much loved Tom Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
That had a great cast in it. I mean, Mark O'Halloran was in it, Stuart Townsend. Great, great time with Neil Dobine as well. So the reason I got the part, actually, I was actually invited down to my old school to give a talk recently, and I told them the story about Neil Dobine came to see me in a show in the Abbey. His daughter, Sheila, had been the ASM on it. And he goes, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Cornwall. He goes, I know that. He goes, what part? And I went to the man, and he goes, all right. And then he set up a meeting with Joe Dowling, and I got cast in Borselboy basically immediately because of Tobin, which was, I suppose, nepotism. But well, if I knew him, it was nepotism.
Cork nepotism.
It was Cork nepotism. It was favouritism. Let's call it that. Probably not nepotism. But so I did theatre for a while. And then I started to do some films in and around 96, 97. Got to do stuff like This Is My Father with Aidan Quinn and James Caan and stuff like that. Wonderful experiences. And I've always been passionate about film. Now, I love theatre. I absolutely adore theatre. But you couldn't make a living out of it. I remember coming out of the Abbey Theatre one time, and I was rehearsing upstairs for the main stage, and I was downstairs doing a show on the Peacock. But you get paid the same whack, so you don't get paid double bubble. And I remember cashing a cheque and after tax and agents fees walking away with like less than 200 quid for two shows in the National Theatre. And I mean, it's changed now, obviously, and they get paid a lot better. But I remember going, I don't think I can survive this life. It's it's too hard, you know.
Yeah.
So I segued consciously into film and television, and that's where my life has kind of been since, except for a few times I've kind of made forays back onto the stage.
Yeah. So that first play then that you did with Pat McCabe.
Yeah.
Loco County Lonesome, that was in the 90s, which, you know, was nearly 30 years ago, not 10 years ago, which we kind of think in our heads. So that's you being in the acting game for nearly 30 years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've, as you said, you kind of moved towards film and television from your love of theatre. Mm. And that was kind of where you've been working primarily since. But, you know, acting is a tough industry to persist in.
Mm.
So what do you think has contributed to your longevity as an actor?
A few things. Luck obviously plays a massive part, and people underestimate that. I mean, luck is huge in this game. I had a plan, and my plan when I was in my late 20s was I wanted to see what London was like. I wanted to see what Los Angeles was like, and I went and lived in both. And it didn't work out for me. It didn't work out at all. I mean, like, not that I felt flat in my face, but it was hard. It was a struggle. And I had gone from an established place here where I was working, you know, quite a bit. I wouldn't say all the time, but quite a bit. And I gambled and I went just to see what it was like. But then at the end of it, I went, okay, I don't want that. And I knew before I hit 30 years of age that I didn't want that for my life. And good luck to anybody who does, and more power to them, but it wasn't for me. So I knew before I hit 30 that I wanted to live in Dublin. I wanted to buy a home. I wanted to have a family. I wanted, you know, normal things that normal people do. And I came back from Los Angeles and focused on, so what's the game plan? How can you make a living out of this? And one of the things, and, you know, something we share in common is I discovered that I have a voice for radio. And I did a couple of demos and I got involved in a couple of cartoons and everything else. And Voice Bank, Deborah at Voice Bank, I sent her in a reel and she took me on, and that has been, you know, it's never going to be your main income, but it's a fantastic subsidiary income to back up what you're doing as an actor and as a writer. And I've been so fortunate, so blessed that that's been in my life, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be such a challenge as an actor and creative of any type, really, to make a living in this industry. Yeah. And we have to spin a lot of plates and it can be really, you know, it's a whole other side of it, you know, the business side, because when you are a creative or an actor and you know, you have agents and things like that, but you kind of stand for yourself and you kind of have to, because if you expect other people to do all the legwork for you, you'd probably be waiting by the phone for months and months and months and it's gathering dust. So developing that business aspect of yourself is really important. Mm. And also on top of that, I feel, you know, you started off with your psychology and English degree. Do you think that your knowledge of psychology and your ability to really engage with people and be a people person has also contributed to your success and your ability to continue?
I'm not sure about the psychology part of it, but I'm definitely an extrovert. I'm definitely an outgoing person. I love people. I love meeting people. And I've formed some fantastic relationships in this business, in the, like, Paul Ellis from McConnell's, for instance, you would know.
Oh, yeah, I am still in touch with him. Yeah.
So when I joined Voice Bank, I was walking down Haddington Road, and Paul Ellis is this legendary figure in advertising, as you know.
With the glasses.
With the glasses. He was standing outside Smith's, and I get a whistle across the road, and he goes, "Come over to me, you." I said, "Right." He says, "Have you joined Voice Bank?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I'm going to look after you." And I said, "Don't bullshit me now, Paul." I said, like, because, you know, you don't want to get carried away, but like, you'd be buying a house 5 seconds later as an actor, you know what I mean? So the following week, he called me in to take over from Donal McCann, who had died as the voice of Ballygun. Then after that, he got me in for ESB, and I think then O2. And I was up and running within a month. And this was literally because this guy had went, you know,
yeah,
I like you, and, you know, I think I can work with you. And
I like the cut of your jib, and I like your shorts.
And he gave me stop going on about the shorts. When you're the bloody listeners are going to think I have two twigs for legs. But I've actually lovely legs, footballer's legs.
He's got lovely legs.
Stop flirting with me about my legs. But anyway, so Paul Ellis gave me a shot. And I remember when I got married, Paul was at my wedding. And I said to him when I walked over, and I had a couple of jars, of course, on my wedding day. And I said, "I don't think I'd have been able to buy a house if it wasn't for you, because you literally got the ball rolling." And I've so much to be grateful to him for, actually. Huge, huge amount to be, and, you know, and this is the thing about this career. Remember at the time, the people who give you your shot, and people have. In film and telly, so Frank Berry, for instance, like, I've worked with Frank like 4 or 5 times. You know, Stuart Carlin, David Caffrey, you know, all these people, like, just been hugely instrumental in my career, and have gone, "You know what, I like what you're doing, I'm going to give you a shot." And then, you know, obviously become friends with them, and you have relationships going forward. But I think that's really important in this career, is to be grateful for the people who give you a bit of a break, because who knows where it's going to lead to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that kind of comes back to the relationship side of things, and, you know, not so much the psychology, as you say, but, you know, that ability to connect with people so easily that you have, you know, and your extrovert nature and being able to make friends. And that's fantastic.
But I love people. I love people. I think that kind of feeds into being an actor as well. I think that, like, you're not sitting studying people, but you're always absorbing. There's always something going in, you know. Even with the writing, which we'll get to in a minute, I actually was walking down here going, what have I read or seen recently that has interested or has influenced stuff that I've written? So during lockdown, I mean, I was up on Mount Street in Moynihan Russell, doing a voiceover for the government. And I was reading, and the text I was reading was frightening. And I looked to your man and I just went, "Is this as bad as what I'm saying here?" And he said, "You will not be in a studio for a year, if not two." And I nearly lost my life. I was like, I've got a young child, I've got a mortgage, I've got a wife, I've got, you know. And I went home straight away, and I got on to Tommen. I actually have the same reflector shield that you have up there. Got on to Tommen in Germany and ordered all the gear, and literally turned the spare room at home into a kind of a working studio. And that's how I managed to navigate lockdown, you know. And then I had this. So writing wise, just to give you a bit of background, I've always loved writing, but I think I hung around with a lot of writers when I was in my early 20s who were so unbelievably talented, like Dave Hannigan, Dennis Walsh, Paul Howard. All these guys are just brilliant, brilliant writers, like multi-award winning writers. We all know who they are. And I think because of what they were doing, I lacked the confidence to explore that side. And it took me a while to get going.
Yeah.
So what happened was I had an idea for a short film, and it was kind of swirling around in my head. And I woke up bolt upright at 2 o'clock in the morning at home. And Rebecca went, "Jesus, what's wrong with you?" And I said, I have the idea. I know what it is. She goes, "Go downstairs and write it." So by 7 a.m. it was finished. And not a syllable of that script changed. So that short was called Blink. And we ended up just, you send it out to film festivals, you hope one of them will buy it or whatever. But luckily for us, one of those was the Montreal World Film Festival. And it was nominated in world competition.
Wow.
It was like 9,000 films entered. So
wow.
We got that recognition and that kind of, you know, gave a little bit of a cachet towards, you know, you can do this, you know, you can, and that was self-financed. So there was no public money available for that. So that got the ball rolling. Then after that, I wrote a very, very personal film called While You Were Gone, about two strangers who meet at a group bereavement counselling session. And they're the only two people in the room who can't articulate their grief. And within the silence, they begin to find each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they go off on this journey of healing and discovery. And the juxtaposition is their lives are crumbling even further down around their ears. But about two thirds the way through, there's this massive twist. And we find out why these two stars have collided in orbit at this particular point in time. And it's a kind of a race to the finish to see if they can repair their lives or ever be in each other's lives again,
mm-hmm.
which is a hugely, hugely personal film, which I think I'd love to direct it actually at some point, because I have directed ads and stuff before. But and then I got back to writing during lockdown because, you know this. I mean, you might get one, two, maybe three voiceovers and that's it for the week. And you're doing the homeschooling and you're doing everything else. And I had this idea. I remember my best pal saying to me in 1999 in Toners on Baggot Street that I had told him that I was going to write a film about the famine. In 99, I was like, how do you remember this stuff? And I sat down. I had written the treatment with a guy called David Rodham, who was a director in special effects. Fantastic guy, actually. And we went back and visited the treatment. And I said, I think I want to write this. He said, well, go for it. So I started delivering pages every day and he'd go through with and we'd action them. And the thing about him is he's a wonderful visuals guy. Like he will send you the most beautiful art, the most beautiful. And then he sent you the most beautiful books of poetry, like Richard Hugo and stuff. And unbelievable. He would send you, you need to watch this film by Vaclav Maroul called The Painted Bird. And he'd send you a link and he'd have paid for it. And he's like, and he's just cramming you full of these wonderful visual images that will infuse your work. And it ended up then, so it's called Blight and it's about the famine and it's a very contained picture about a community. It's not the epic sprawling whole of Ireland story.
Yes.
It's one community which serves as a metaphor for the community at large and for the whole of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So finished that, sent it out into the world and got some amazing feedback. The feedback in general was they're not going to give you $20 million to do this off the bat. You need to make something
first
that's got a lower budget, that's a bit more containable and filmable. So I've always wanted to write a Western. So
so from the Irish countryside to
the West.
So Wild West.
I wrote a Western called A Violent Prayer with Dave. Dave was, you know, sending me all the visuals and the usual. And we have this shorthand, this lovely way of working where it's like, he'll give me this and I'll go ahead and write it. He sent me this obscure Eastern European artist. He sent me some visuals and it became a nightmare of the main character in this one nightmare that he has in the throes of a fever.
Yeah.
I brought that then to life, you know what I mean? But I wouldn't have been able to do it without that, you know what I mean? So A Violent Prayer is about a bounty hunter and a kid on the trail of the Wild West's most notorious serial killer, which is loosely based on a true story. And it's episodic. So every chapter we meet a new displaced, disenfranchised person who is symbolic of the new world crashing into the old world and how America hasn't really changed at all. And it's a kind of a polemic about that. And also as well, it's a kind of a journey into the heart of darkness. It's about violence. It's about violence against women in particular. It's about racism. That's A Violent Prayer. So that's out there. That's with a big American producer at the moment. So we'll see what happens.
Watching this space.
It is getting quite a bit of attention. But again, look.
Have the contract in your hand.
I even say to people, it's like not even that. I say when they shout cut.
Yeah.
I still don't believe it'll happen. Yeah. But anyway, look,
you get used to uncertainty, don't you, in this line of work?
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of hopefulness and possibility. And sometimes you have these moments of anything could change right now. You know, my whole life can change. If this just works, and often it doesn't. And how do you kind of come back from that?
There's people reading this who I mean, it's because, I mean, it's, let's be honest about it. I mean, Rodham is currently working on Gladiator 2, so he's Ridley's right-hand man with special effects. And he, like, his contact list is just unbelievable. The people that he can get this into their hand. I mean, James Gray has read it. You know, some like there's some major, major, you know, movie stars have read it and stuff. But look, again, let's not get carried away. Let's just be pragmatic and see where it takes us. And then I got commissioned to write a script for the last year and a half, which is a real life story about this boy. It's kind of, it's like Billy Elliot, but about sport.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a boy from, you know, the this disadvantaged background who overcomes all the obstacles. I mean, mental health, kind of, you know, poverty, drugs, everything, to become, you know, this sports star. So that's chugging along very nicely. So that's going great. So that was commissioned by a guy called Damien Varley, who I've been working with, and he's great. I mean, he's an ex-former international rugby player. So he's driven to the nth degree. I mean, and the great thing about him is he's such a straight shooter. He'll just give it to you straight. There's no embellishment there. He's not worried about your ego. He's not worried about, he's just like, this is what I want. And you're like, okay. Which is, you know, for me, it's a new way of working because everything else had come for me, you know?
Yeah. And is so open to interpretation. So when someone is just giving you really strong parameters, it kind of maybe gives you even a bit more freedom in a way.
I wouldn't say more freedom, actually.
You'd probably not
thank me for saying it, but I've loved working with him because you always know where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in this business, you know as well as I do.
That's a rare feeling.
Sometimes you don't know where you are, even on a set.
Mm.
You don't know what a director wants. You don't know what the producers expect.
Even if they verbalize it to you, because so much can get lost in translation between what one person says and what another person hears.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, great to have somebody who's giving you really strong direction.
No, I've really, really enjoyed working with him, and I think he's going to do a great job on the picture as well. He's done two shorts, which are really, really great shorts, and I think he's ready, and I think he's ready to go. And he's like, just has that great determination, that singularity of vision that I suppose somebody who was an international rugby player has. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So you have all of these screenplays and at various stages of development. Mm. And you also have your novel Mojo, which is now available on Amazon.
Nice plug.
So writing is not really something that's just a side hustle for you. It feels like it's something that you're pivoting more firmly towards all the time. Would that be a true
estimation? No, I love doing them in tandem. I mean, I adore acting. I love it. I love playing characters. It's something I've enjoyed doing for so long. And do you know what? This is the great thing. I know people bullshit about this and say, oh, getting old is great. As a man, it actually is. And I know there's a terrible imbalance there, and I'm hugely aware of that. But you do get to play more interesting guys because they've lived a life. Mm-hmm. They've more experience.
Yeah.
Whereas like when you're playing the young buck, and, you know, sometimes you're just there as, you know, men and women as the eye candy who don't do much thinking.
Mm.
But when you reach my age, they want you to have had a backstory, and they want you to have thought about what's going on. And it's funny, I either get to play the really bad guy or the really good guy.
And never in between, never. The shades of grey.
No.
But yeah, so over the years, you've played a number of characters who are based on real life people as well, such as, you know, Sean Doherty, former Minister for Justice in the historical drama Charlie, based on Charlie Haughey's life, alongside Aidan Gillen.
Yeah.
And you also portrayed Patrick Pearse in The Bloody Irish for PBS. What do you think it is that draws casting directors to cast you in such roles?
Funny. Do you want to hear the story about how I got cast as Sean Doherty?
Please, let us know.
I was in Montreal, and I was outside the Cinema Imperial. And there were two posters on the wall. One was for Blink, Orphan. The other one was for A Thousand Times Goodnight by Juliette Binoche was in it. Eric Poppet was the director. And Maureen Hughes cast A Thousand Times Goodnight.
Really?
And here we were, our two posters side by side in, you know, and it was a lovely moment. So I took a picture and texted it to Maureen and got no response. So and Maureen won't mind me telling the story. But after like 4 or 5 days, I was going, you stupid. Bollocks, why did you do that? Now you're going to look really clunky and cheesy doing that. And then the following day, my agent rang and said, they want to see you for Sean Doherty and Charlie. And I'd already alerted the agent and said, listen, I share some physical similarities with this guy. So there's a chance that I could, you know, at least get seen for it and go for it, whatever. So I came home and learned the script on the flight home and came in and walked from Dublin Airport. Well, I got a taxi, but I walked literally in the door from the airport to meet Kenny Glenan, the director, and Maureen was sitting there, and that was
it. She said thanks for that text.
She didn't. She just was hugely complimentary about where I had been and getting so far in the competition and stuff. And sometimes you're right for a role. It's just that, you know, it's just that inexplicable thing that you just sometimes you're right. And I think I was right for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other people could have done a great interpretation of it. But I think in that moment, my age, where I was in my career and everything else, I think that I was probably the right choice for that. And I can't say that for many other times in my life, but for that one, I think I probably was.
Yeah.
And like I worked extremely hard then as well,
yeah,
at getting the look of him right, you know?
Yeah. What draws you to roles like that based on historical figures or even infamous characters, do you think?
I don't think a lot of it, I don't think it's about being drawn towards it. I think a lot of it is that if the choice comes up, and you get a chance to play that, like, it's like doing a mini history degree.
Mm-hmm.
I love history anyway, for a start, as you can probably see by, you know, what I've written. I love history. And I just think trying to be somebody else who was real, there's no safety net.
How do you go about preparing for a role like that?
So, for instance, with Sean Doherty, there was a couple of fantastic documentaries. There was one by Steve Carson and Miriam O'Callaghan about Charlie, and Doherty figured hugely in it. And then John Waters, who, you know, obviously has gone on to different things since, but he wrote a great book called Jiving at the Crossroads, which was literally a roadmap of how to play Doherty, because it was about him.
Mm.
And all these little things that you would learn. I mean, every time I saw a picture of him, he was using his left hand, and I'm right-handed. Now, I don't know if he's right-handed or left-handed to this day, but I would start practicing with my left hand and change what side. I would pick up a phone, open my button, drink my tea. And accent is massive for me. And the Roscommon accent is a very, very peculiar one. But Shane Curran, the Roscommon goalkeeper, I knew. And I was like, on to Shane, going, listen, what's the crack? And again, this is what I go back and say to you. People are lovely and hugely helpful when you do ask for their help, you know. So just study and repetition. I keep repeating, like, I read the script oodles of times. Like I read the script nearly every day.
Hmm.
And when I'm learning my lines, I record them in character into at the time it was a dictaphone, now it's a phone, and I walk around listening to me and seeing what can get better, what can improve. And in terms of look, I had to put on weight to play that.
Mm.
No, I can't take all the credit here. Like, I mean, I went into, was it Kathy Strachan, actually? I went in with a folder and I opened it up and I had pictures of Doherty, you know, from over the years. And she said, come here and I'll show you something. And she had a rack of every suit I had a picture of.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, that's how good she is.
Wow.
And then when we went into hair and makeup, Denise Watson and I think it was Sandra Kelly, they said, look, let's work on the look. And they were dyeing my hair and everything else. And I actually was best man at a wedding with a big shock of red hair. And everybody looking at me going, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, like, what happened to him? But in the middle of it. But I think that was one of the best acting experiences, as in playing a character, of my career. I loved every minute. Like, Aidan is sensational in that. He's brilliant in it. Tom Vaughan Lawler is brilliant in it. And, you know, you're
great cast.
Well, you're going to work with these boys every day, you know. They're going to raise your game, you know. Mm. And Aidan and I have since gone on to become, you know, quite good friends and stuff. And he's very, very generous in a scene, you know. He'll give you what you need. In character, by the way. And all my stuff was with Aidan, really, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I loved it. I loved the show. I loved working with him.
The process.
I loved the process. The director, yeah. Kenny Glenan, was an absolute superstar, a little Scottish bundle of energy coming in like a fucking tornado every morning, you know. So I loved working with him. And that's, I suppose, that's the creative side of it. I love that. But I mean, there's been other jobs where I've had the crack then, you know what I mean? I was on The Alienist in Budapest.
Yeah.
I was walking through Dublin Airport. My phone pinged and it was Peter Coonan, you know,
yeah.
played Fran in Love Hate. And he says, are you heading to Budapest? And I said, I am. Why? And he goes, I'm in Butler's. Come in and have a coffee. Now, if you're going to Budapest for 2 months.
We all know what you're doing.
No, I'll tell you. If you're going to Budapest for 2 months, no better man to be hanging in Budapest with than Peter Coonan, because he is the loveliest man. You know, he's an exceptional actor and really dedicated to his work, but loves going for dinner, like me, loves going for a swim, loves going for the baths.
Yeah.
And loves. We ended up like playing pick-up football with kids in a park and everything, you know what I mean? Just sitting like...
Two locals. Yeah.
And so that in terms of... So that was Stuart Carlin and David Caffrey had me on that. But just to spend that time over there with... You know, it was like the Irish mafia over there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was just fantastic. And Coonan, my God, what a legend. He's just the loveliest man.
Yeah. And coming back now to your characters and the roles you play and how you prepare for them, have you ever found yourself struggling with your personal feelings about a character that you've had to play before, a character that you've been building? And, you know, whether that's a real life one or a fictional one. And if yes, how would you separate yourself from the characters you portray?
The short answer is no. The longer answer is longer and more complex. Somebody said to me years ago when I was starting that when you're playing the antagonist, that you have to find the humanity in them, because an antagonist doesn't know that he's a bad person. So you still in character have to know that and believe that what you're doing is true. And I think it was when I was playing Danforth in The Crucible. I used to go down to the forecourts and study judges every day. And when I had been on the floor rehearsing, it was big and it was a bit oiky. It wasn't great. And then I went down and I studied these judges, they were so still and they controlled everything with their voice. And it was just mesmeric to watch. And then I brought that into my character. And my character, even though he was hanging people, he thought he was doing the will of God.
Mm.
So from an audience perspective, yeah, he looks like an evil bastard, but he doesn't think he's evil. So if you start there, and then, I mean, you know, you work a backstory for your character anyway, you know, but none of that backstory would be, I did this bad thing and then I did that. You're just a person who happens to do bad things or do a bad thing for a living. Like in a recent thing, I had to, actually, the long answer is this. I did a show recently where I had to traffic a child as a gangster, and when we went into that scene, I was very upset afterwards. It did bleed into my life.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It can be so easy for actors to bleed into the characters they create, you know, whether they're practicing, you know, the full method approach or maybe just a lack of boundaries between themselves and the character they play, or even just, you know, a lack of boundaries in general. But would you see yourself as following any one particular discipline in that area, you know, following a method or following a particular technique in acting, or,
We did study Stanislavski in college, but I've used various techniques over the years. I mean, funnily, we did a thing called animal studies in Trinity when I was there. And I kind of ask myself the question sometimes, what is the character if he was going to be an animal? But The short answer is physicality, voice, and then get into the psychology of the character. And maybe this is where the psychology is, understanding what this character's, what's his place in the story, because ultimately you're there to serve the story. I mean, we've seen loads of people who think that they're there for themselves and just, you know, are going to give this knockout performance and then they go, yeah, but the film is shit. So there's no point in you having a knockout performance if the film's crap. You have to understand your place within the framework, within the story, and connect all those dots. And then you bring it back and you study your character and you go, who am I? Where am I? What am I doing? Where am I going? What do I do to get where I'm going? In every scene. They are the questions, the fundamental questions that you ask yourself. And if you can answer those questions truthfully as your character, then you're on the right track.
Mm. And what do you think has been your standout role in your career so far?
I think everybody would say Doherty, wouldn't they? I think so. Mackin in Taken Down was another one that I absolutely loved playing. I loved that team, you know. I remember myself and Orla Fitzgerald, you know, Orla Fitzgerald from the Win the Shakes of Barley's and yeah. Young Offenders, just wonderful actress. Orla's an incredible attitude to the work. So at lunchtime, we'd sit in each other's trailer and work out the scene and work out the relationships between us and stuff. So much so that they were like putting a B camera on us to capture our reactions and stuff, you know, because of the relationship we were creating. What was the start of that question?
Your best role.
That role, I kind of feel that was the one who got away in terms of I would have loved to have seen if it had run a bit further, where it could have gone. Caffo, obviously, David Caffey, dream to work with.
And he's a great director.
He's, but also, to be around, his positivity, his energy.
He's great fun.
But Stuart Carlin is a genius. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. He is. He's an absolute genius. I mean, I remember him telling me a story of how he was going to follow on with Taken Down, and he just wove this tapestry in a car. We were sitting outside today FM and I was going in to actually do a voiceover, and he started weaving this tapestry. It was so complicated that I was, you know, when you're nearly dwarfed by somebody's intellect, I was just looking at him going, where the fuck do you come up with this stuff? It's incredible. And he's one of our best. I mean, he's just a genius. I think, you know, along with Frank Berry, who, you know, I've long since been a fan of, Lenny, Aisling Walsh is somebody I love. Dervla Walsh, incredible. It was that Mackin, because again, he wasn't a bad person, but he was taking the shortest route possible to get the job done because he was jaded by the job.
Yeah.
So there were reasons for him doing what he did. The one thing I didn't enjoy about it is I had to put on 2 stone to play it.
That's a big ask, isn't it, for an actor?
It is, and I was moving really, really differently and stuff, and I kind of got sick of it after a while, but I said, look, if we were going again, that I'll be walking into scene one in season two with a gym bag going, hey, everybody, look at me, I'm buff.
I just really wanted to, you know, get ready for the summer.
Toned up, yeah. But I loved that, and we the four cops were Lynn Rafferty, Sean Fox, myself and Orla Fitz, and we'd a lovely bond. We're still in a WhatsApp group, we still meet. We go to the theatre together and we go, you know, for dinner and stuff. So it was a lovely bunch, you know.
Yeah.
And I would have, COVID obviously happened and everything else. I mean,
everything sort of just shuts down and gets put on hold.
The Alienist was meant to, was another one that we were hoping would run. But like the world just changed,
yeah.
You know, and things that you thought you were going to be on for a few years, just you weren't anymore. And then
just filtered away.
Yeah, we just had to get busy doing other stuff.
Yeah.
Like homeschooling.
Homeschooling and writing.
And tweeting. My tweet about the homeschooling. Did you remember that one?
Tell me about it again.
I said that it may take a village to raise a child, but it takes a vineyard to homeschool one.
Did that one go viral?
It did. Yeah. That was what did somebody say recently in an interview? Twitter star Gavin O'Connor. I was like, thanks a million. That's great.
You'll have that on your tombstone.
Yeah, that'll be the eulogy. He was a Twitter star 4 times in his life.
It's a great feeling though when something you tweet goes viral. You kind of feel like this is it.
The first time it happened, I never turned off the notifications and my phone was like a bloody, I don't know what, fucking vibrator in my hand. It was when Margaret Thatcher died and the hashtag was Iron Lady, and I said my thoughts and prayers are with Tony Stark at this terrible time. Right, so the phone went, I think it was either Rob Delaney or Darrow Breen or somebody retweeted it, and of course when somebody with their following retweets it, the thing was mental. But I never had the notifications turned off. I couldn't even get phone calls. The thing was like one for 24 hours going. Oh, it was so funny. But yeah, so yeah, Mackin. I loved Mackin. I loved Sean Doherty. Oh, like, come here. I've been really blessed. You know, I feel really, really lucky. And then, you know, we've got this, you know, I've got this new strand of my career, hopefully heading in the right direction as well. Yeah. You know, but probably be back here now next year, cleaning the hall or something. And you'd be saying, "What happened to you?" Like, it's all over.
Well, up and down the peaks and troughs. I mean, it's just normal that the career would go up and down. But I feel like we won't see you here with a scrubbing pan and brush.
Well, look, if you do, you do. But I mean, we'll have to, we have to put a 12-year-old through school, so we'll do what we can. Was there...
Absolutely, yes. And so just coming back to what you were saying about, you know, COVID happening and certain things that you thought would just keep going, closing down for a while, or, you know, those kind of sparks of promise that can happen in this industry. And then sometimes they don't lead to anything. Is there anything, any role or any potential job that could have happened for you that you really, really wanted to to make real?
The big one in my life was I was down to the last two to play one of the leads in The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Wow.
And it was 5 weeks I was held on.
Wow.
Now, I was a very young man at the time, but Ken Loach would have been a hero of mine. I've just loved his work. I mean, I've loved his work for a long, long time. And I met him three times. And I thought, okay, this is it. We're getting close. And I got an email. And this will tell you how long ago it is. Andrew Street, there was an internet cafe. I had to go and check my email in an internet cafe.
Yeah,
And I opened it up and there was an email.
That's 2010, carry on, isn't it?
2004 or 5.
Right.
And there was an email from my agent saying, unfortunately, they went the other way. And I remember coming out onto the street and Andrew Street.
The worst phrase that any actor can hear.
Oh, I was gutted. I thought I was so right for it. But look, you know, I don't believe in any of that. What's for you won't pass you by or any of that bullshit. I think sometimes you do, you know, actually, you know.
Sometimes you just miss out on
you
things.
You do miss out. You do.
Either they make the wrong decision or you make the wrong decision, or, you know, it just didn't work out.
This is probably somebody going around going, I was in, you know, for Doherty or Mackin and I didn't get it and you got it. So
yeah, whenever one actor wins the part, you know, there are 20, 30, 40, maybe even a couple of hundred who they were close.
Well, if you look at our gene pool now of actors, I mean, 4 Oscar nominations.
It's fantastic.
It's unbelievable. I mean, like I did a film with Kerry Condon called This Must Be the Place. That must be 18 years ago.
Yeah.
So Kerry is like, we've all known Kerry's been this talented for forever, but now she's really, really getting the recognition, you know.
Yeah, it's this golden period for Irish cinema, isn't it? It's amazing.
And like, you know, Paul and Gladiator.
Yeah.
You know, Colin and Brendan, Donal. Jesus, it's just fantastic. It really is. That would be the dream, by the way.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, Blight. What would be a dream come true for you career-wise, whether it's, you know, as an actor or as a writer? What's on your bucket list?
Okay. As an actor, I want to continue to do interesting roles. I've never really set out to be famous or any of that kind of crack. I don't think it would suit me, for one.
What do you think would happen?
I think I'd find the constant intrusion a bit much, to be honest, you know. I mean, listen, I just like plodding along and you get the odd person every now and again when you've been on the telly the night before. I go, oh, listen, I saw you last night. That's fine with me. But my dream is for Blight to be made and to have a predominantly, there is an English character in it, but a predominantly Irish cast of amazing actors that you can go to the world and everybody will know who they are. And that will be what sells it. Because this is our story. I don't think it's been told before. I know Ruan Mangan did an amazing documentary. I don't know if you saw it. That Liam Neeson narrated, just incredible work. But I don't think we have told this in a film, in a dramatic film yet. And I wonder, are we still ashamed? But maybe the time is right now to go, you know, that we've come through it. We've come through it and we're okay and we're doing well and we're fighting on a world stage. But this is our story. This is our backstory. And this is the reason why people are in the four corners of the earth. From Ireland, is because of this period of history.
Yeah,
and I would love to show that film to the world and have it an international film. I don't want it to be a small Irish film that's seen, you know, in a few cinemas. I want this to be big.
Well, we've seen with films like The Quiet Girl that it's possible.
Absolutely, isn't it beautiful to see that?
It is. It's amazing, an Irish language film.
Yeah.
to be able to take its place on the world stage.
Well, no, if you're going to talk about that, I feel, and I love that movie, and I think Colm Baridge did an incredible job, and I'm a Gaelgor as well, so, you know, I mean, I have a particular interest in this field. I think Tom O'Sullivan's Aroch, I don't think without that, any of this would have happened. I think Aroch was an incredible film. I think it's beautiful to look at. Same cinematographer, Kate, doing amazing work again, Kate McCulloch. Donald's central performance, absolutely incredible what he did. I mean, you're talking a world-class performance there by Donal O'Haly. But COVID happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that...
It affected a lot of the films that came out at that time.
I feel that that stole a little bit of momentum of that film because I thought it was a beautiful film. I really did. And then when On Colleen Kuhn came along, I kind of went, brilliant. At least this is getting the chance to get out there, to get out into the world, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, it's, oh my God, at the end, when she jumped into his arms, oh my Jesus, I was broken. I was sitting with my wife and son in the Stella in Rathmines. I was broken in two. I couldn't even talk. Like, it's such a beautiful film. But I think that Tom's Aroch has to take some of the credit for breaking down the Irish language barrier a little before that. And I think that that may have been lost slightly in the conversation, which I just think that's just an incredible film as well.
Yeah.
There's some great stuff. Fosca is a great film as well.
I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, Fosca is another one. And I think it's only a matter of time. I mean, they came up against All Quiet on the Western Front, to be fair, which is an epic, you know. If that film hadn't come out, I think you could be looking at an Oscar. Like, I think you could. If people just loved it. It was a love story that cinema goers post-COVID were wanting to see something beautiful, and there it was in front of them. Yeah. And they didn't care what language it was in. It was just the most beautiful, simple story done beautifully.
Well, I mean, if French cinema can win,
you
know, on an international stage, why not Irish cinema? Absolutely. I know that we don't have the chops in the same way as French cinema. It has a long history of...
But look at the actors you have here who do speak Irish, for instance, right? So Brendan Gleeson is a Gaelgor. Lorcan Cranage, amazing actor, Gaelgor. Dennis Conway. You know, there's some... Donal O'Haly. Like, you've brilliant, brilliant actors here who can speak in our native tongue. Why not put them all in a film? Why not give it a crack? Do you know what I mean? Let's put marquee names in a movie and go for it.
And would you want Blight to be Osquelga?
It's written in English, so no, because there's a thing that I did with it, which was it's written in Victorian English. And there's a reason why that is, and it comes to pass in the script. So no is the short answer. But if somebody said, if you translate that, here's 10 million quid and you can make it, that's a different conversation, of course.
Well, absolutely. All you need is the paycheck.
No. And hopefully make a good film.
So, Gavin O'Connor, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, to chat to you about everything that's been, everything that's happening. And I want to just ask you one final question, which is, what's next for you?
What's next for me? So I just delivered a pass on a script and I am about to... I think I'm going to start on another one. Yeah, I'm waiting to hear back on a BBC job. And that's the thing about, you know, being an actor is that, you know, we're constantly...
waiting in the wings in a way.
Well, you're constantly auditioning and waiting to hear back on jobs and stuff. So I'm up for this BBC job at the moment. I did a thing called The Hunt for Rowan Moat in England, which did very well. It was a real life story about this guy who went...
It was an ITV drama, is that right?
Yeah. So it was like 6 million viewers in the UK, which is phenomenal. Absolutely.
And that was a huge news story a few years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the thing about him, Rowan Moat, was he went on the rampage in Newcastle. He came out of prison and he shot his ex-girlfriend, Sam Stobart, and her boyfriend, Chris Brown, shot him dead, shot her and left her with life-threatening injuries, and then went around hunting cops and shot a policeman called David Rathband in the face and blinded him with a shotgun, and he ended up taking his own life. So then he went on the run, and the biggest manhunt in UK history ensued, where people came from, you know, Greater Manchester Police, Northumbria, the Met, PSNI even came over, you know, and they all went hunting this guy. But I suppose, because at the time live news was becoming a thing. Sky were covering it, BBC were covering it. So it was a live feed all day, every day on Sky. And Gaza famously turned up at the in Rothbury at the site. And he was told sharpish to get away. I think Gaza was coming off a 72-hour coke bender when he decided that he was the man to talk your man down from the ledge with a shotgun under his chin, you know.
Yeah.
You know, logic and reason and accountability out the window with Gaza here. But so I got a call. So Carlene Crawford, who was amazing casting agent in the UK, who had seen me for a Ken Loach movie, another one, and remembered me. And the real life character in my thing is a guy called Steve Neal, who's from, I'll tell you a funny story, I'll probably get in trouble for this, but I don't care. So Steve Neal's from Bambridge, County Down, right? So he talks like that. And when I went over for the read-through, one of the honchos from ITV had heard me speaking in my normal Cork accent, you know? And he goes, oh my God, he goes, it's like listening to him. He goes, you're so like him. And I didn't have the heart to tell him that I couldn't be further away on the island of Ireland from your man, like from Cork to bloody Bambridge, County Down. So I just said, thank you very much, and fucking turned around and went on my way, you know. But it was just one of those moments where you just smile and go, look, I'm glad to have the job. But that, we filmed it in Leeds because the story is still quite sensitive in Newcastle. And we came at it from the perspective of the victims. So what we wanted to do was tell their story, not glorify this monster, which we didn't at all. I mean, we didn't. And I think the reviews were very, very kind about that as well, you know. So I think we wanted to tell the victim stories, but it was one of those ones, but there wasn't a massive fanfare about it because of the sensitivity of the story. But
yeah,
the public really tuned in, like mass. I mean, a tenth of the UK population, like that's unbelievable.
So it was what people wanted at the time. Yeah.
So I'm hoping the BBC were watching and then they give me this job and then that'll answer the question, which is what's next? Which would be great.
Well, let's end up a prayer to the acting gods. Thank you. Of BBC that they will come through for you this week.
Thanks very much, Remy.
Great to have you, Gavin.
Lovely talking to you. Thank you so much.
For Tech's Sake is a podcast that goes beyond the hype of tech developments to bring listeners the knowledge they need to make informed decisions. And it's hosted by me, Elaine Burke, a science and technology journalist.
And me, Jenny Darmody, editor of Silicon Republic.
Each episode, we're joined by an expert to answer our probing questions to discover what's good tech and what's just tech for tech's sake.
And we've had some amazing guests this season, including roboticist Niamh Donnelly. She was just named Woman of the Year in STEM by Irish Tattler.
We also had Ireland's AI ambassador, Dr. Patricia Scanlon, Stripe CTO David Singleton, and Bobby Healy, CEO of Irish drone company Mana.
And last season, we had Abiba Berhane, who was recently appointed to a UN advisory panel on AI.
We certainly know how to pick them. And if you want to be in the know on tech, robotics, drones, AI, and what have you, on a deeper and more human level, be sure to subscribe.